Okay, the time is 8:32 a.m. on July 25th, 2023, and I'm convening this video conference and telephone conference meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act and the Association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on July 17, 2023 and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. Copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved as all 9 directors have been confirmed as attending in person or by video or audio conference. Also in attendance are Board Counsel Shelby Betts, General Counsel Jackie Rickson, Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association Executive Director Bart Bowles, and TLHIGA employees Jarrett Terry and Topping Haggerty. And from the Texas Department of Insurance, we have Vane Hugo, John Walker, Brian Rewey, Caitlin Bain, Jeff Jones, and Kenesha Schuster. So the first agenda item is consideration and possible action on consent agenda items. The summary of the official minutes from the April 18th and May 10th meetings of the Board of Directors and ratification of the payment of Novus fees and expense billing for fourth quarter of 2023. Do I have a motion then?
This is James Huckabee. Motion to approve.
Ted Kennedy.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you very much. Item number 2 on the agenda.
Pardon me for interruption. Bart, we cannot see the board material on the Zoom meeting.
Okay, sorry.
It's not share screen.
I thought I'd already shared it. Now you have it.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, so we're not aware of anything from TDI, but Vane, do you have anything?
We don't have anything with the open meeting.
With the open meeting, okay. So on to item number 3, consideration possible action on reports and recommendations from the Personnel Committee. So, Mr. Huckabee, you are up.
Okay. At our meeting on July 18th, we did talk about the non-salary benefits provided to Texas Life Health Insurance Guarantee Association employees. Bart went over that. No significant changes from last year. There was a total benefits increased by $3,556, representing 77% more than last year. Slight increase in office visit for the employees. We covered that. If you want more detail, we can definitely provide that to you. Elements of the executive director's employment contract. We discussed that BOIT has achieved as required to for the pay, longevity pay in December of 2023 based on his contract that was signed in 2018. One of the components was that he was to have an average score at least a 4.0 of the categories. His overall score was 4.92, and he did accomplish that. So that contract calls for him to receive a longevity pay in December. The other thing, the evaluations will be sent to the board members in November. and those will be turned. So that's in the calendar when those will come out. Same process as we have used for the last 5 years, I believe. And there is no recommendation from the committee regarding any changes needed for the for our charter. And that's it, unless someone has a question.
Well, speaking of personnel, Frank, I think this is your first meeting.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Yeah, Bart, do you have anything you want to say?
No, just Frank Beeman is our new public director. And Mr. Beeman, we were such in a hurry to jump into the meaty part of the meeting, we should have welcomed you. But if you could take just a moment and introduce yourself, I think everyone here would appreciate that.
No problem at all, Director Wells. Thank you. I'm Frank Beeman. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Faith Community Health System, home base office in Jacksboro, Texas. I am really proud and honored to be a part of the organization. You caught us at a good time. The COVID fairy decided to visit my family this weekend, so I'm actually at home and recovering from COVID, as is my wife. Anyway, hope to be an active participant and willing to serve.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here, and we know your insights from your role there with your hospital are going to be beneficial to a lot of the work we have going on, and maybe you'll find some of our discussion today very interesting.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right, Jim.
Is that everything for the personnel committee?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so on to item four, consideration and possible action on reports and recommendations from the Assessment Investment Committee meeting.
So, Bart and other committee members can fill in some additional details for anything I missed, but the committee met last Tuesday. Ted, Dean, and myself, everybody was there. We reviewed cash flow projections for specific solvencies, policy obligations, Friday Health being the most notable, but we also had five other life companies that have about $11 million in remaining obligations. By current estimates, and then two others, Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers, that have had a liquidation order entered, but it's on appeal, so everything is stayed for the moment. The obligations there are much larger, about $127 million, or just over $127 million. Texas obligations, and those will activate 90 days after the resolutions of the appeals, whenever that takes place. We reviewed investments. As we've discussed before, there are significant remaining Lincoln Memorial Service funds due mostly to kind of the timing of when we did our assessment and then kind of successful litigation and litigation recoveries. So we have actually more Lincoln Memorial Service funds than we have obligations at the moment. Most of the discussion at the committee was what to do with those remaining funds. We discussed it with staff and council. And given the remaining obligations we have for the kind of five life companies I mentioned, run about $11 million, and the impending much larger obligations we'll have for Colorado Bankers and Bankers Life, the committee thought that it made sense to move those funds into the insolvency expense account, which they can be used to pay for the remaining Lincoln Memorial Service obligations, the five life company obligations, they are life funds. And then when Colorado Bankers and Bankers Life hit, we can use those funds to pay part of that. We'll still need the assessment when those things hit. So we did arrive at a resolution. I don't know if you want to jump to that now, Bart.
I wanted to see if the board might want to have any in-depth questions about this in executive session. Just if they want to ask council any questions, and then we would take action after executive session.
Very good. And then the, I guess two remaining items. We did review our charter for the committee. We had no changes. We also talked about Class A, Class B assessments and refunds. We did not have any recommendation for any Class A or Class B at this time. So I think since we're going to take that other item up in executive session, I think that probably concludes my report.
Okay. Item five is executive session, so I'll read the language to before you hit where you stop recording. So the time is 8:43 a.m. on July 25th, 2023, and I am recessing the regular session of the Board of Directors meeting of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association in order for the board to meet in executive session pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. The time is 10:12 on July 25th, 2023. The executive session of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guaranty Association Board of Directors meetings has concluded, and I am reconvening the regular session of the meeting pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act. And we should, we are on item six, consideration of possible action on items discussed in executive session. And I think you put them up on the screen.
Yeah. And I guess if I can, I would offer the motion that's on the screen as to management of Lincoln Memorial Service Funds.
This is Director James Huckabee. I second the motion.
Any discussion or questions? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. It passes. So quarterly report from the executive director.
This will be quick. I let off there welcoming Director Beeman to the board. Very glad to have you. And sorry you're a little bit under the weather right now. We'd like to see you in person. We will see you in October. Quick update, the ICANN system access that we have been talking with the Department of Insurance about. We talked with Bain and Jamie Walker about this. Bain, you'll be glad to know, I've not abandoned it. I just put it in the back seat for a little while. We got a little busy.
What have you been busy with?
I don't know. I take too many naps. Topping was good to identify all the data elements on ICANN that we think are going to be crucial to us. And we will be sending a request to start working with TDI. What we want to do is obtain periodically a data dump of those elements from ICANN. And then we would build them into our own database that we could use here as a reference tool. So it will be a little bit of work, but this is not something we have to have every day an update. I mean, every 6 months, maybe even annually an update. But it allows us to answer a lot of questions, to explore the history, transactional histories on some companies, both for responding to inquiries, but also for doing some of our assessment work. So we will be resuming our work on the ICANN request very soon.
Just tell you, we got a insurance department complaint where we actually hadn't done anything wrong, but this person first tried to file their beneficiary change with the Great Southwest.
Oh my God!
You remember how long ago that was?
1980.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
It was. I'm sorry. 1990.
Yeah.
1990.
We had assumption reinsurance policy, so we had it, but they first tried to file it with Great Southwest.
I remember taking over that company. I had hired an expert from Milliman First Insolvency. He had worked for the Guaranty Association. And it was James Kennedy's first insolvency to handle as the lead attorney within the Department of Insurance prior.
1989.
And he was in 89, I thought it was 90. Okay.
Well,
and he, our expert made a mistake of parking the wrong parking spot, and James towed his car away.
So, you're probably right. It was 90. James and I both came to TDI in 89. Our first ones were in June and July of
90.
That's right.
That's funny. Oh, wow. Well, yeah, we bought Great Southwest Policies out of receivership. My company did.
That one goes way.
I know.
It sounds like James.
Well, he was thorough.
Unauthorized. Unauthorized story.
All right. I'll give a couple of comments here on some meetings that are coming up. The International Association of Insurance Receivers will have our technical development series workshop on some complex insurance receiverships in September 27th to 29th in San Diego. Jackie, I think you're speaking.
I am, yeah.
And I think Chris Fuller is speaking and several others that we know. I'm doing my normal support to save IAIR money. I'm doing all the AV work for IAIR. So it'll be a hybrid with both in-person and virtual attendees and presenters. Then the NAIC meeting, the summer meeting, will be coming up August 12th and 16th in Seattle. And I will be attending that as normal. And at the NAIC meeting, there are always IAIR committee meetings. I chair a couple of those. I'll also be hosting a roundtable discussion, and then there will be an IAIR board meeting during the NAIC. The last MPC meeting of NOLGA was held April 26th and 27th in Milwaukee. It was a productive meeting. We had a lot of special projects we put to bed and were approved. One of those is I chaired for about a year and a half the business continuity plan model redesign. We had a model designed 12 years ago for parent associations to use, and I chaired a committee. We spent about a year and a half redesigning that, so we released it in April. Tomorrow I'll be hosting a roundtable discussion of that model at the next MPC meeting in Chicago. I'll also be giving presentations on the Guaranty Association Administrators Curriculum Committee. We are building a reservoir of information for administrators, and it's not on operations of their Guaranty Associations, but on how insolvencies work, on insolvency issues based and addressed by task forces, some on MPC processes, some on NOLGA processes and protocols. So just a repository of key information that someone can get to quickly and easy when they're facing an issue or serving on a task force for the first time and said, what the heck do I do? In addition, Cindy Oliver and I will be giving a presentation on Friday tomorrow. And there's one, and I'm giving the administration portion of the Penn Treaty presentation tomorrow. So it'll be a busy day tomorrow in Chicago. Thursday and Friday will be NOLGA's 31st legal seminar in Chicago. And it's always a very solid lineup. This will be Peter Glonis's last legal seminar. Peter is retiring at the end of this month. And just last Friday, NOLGA announced Peter's replacement. It's Catherine, I believe she goes by Katie Ward. She was former Connecticut Insurance Commissioner. After leaving office as commissioner, she's had a consulting practice. Before being commissioner, she was with
Cigna
for, I think, 20 years in their government relations area. So a very astute and qualified policy person. So I believe she will begin as NOLGA president the third week of August. And the only other meeting, I'll come back from Seattle August 16th, and I'll be flying to Hawaii on the 19th for a little bit of vacation, and then heading over from Kauai to Oahu for a meeting of the Western State Administrators 27th and 29th of August. So the Western State Administrators are 13 states in the West. You might not think Texas is in the West, but it is in the West, much like the NAIC, we're in the West. So we meet in one of those states each year, and we haven't met in Hawaii ever. So this is our meeting in Hawaii because Peter Inouye travels to all our NOLGA meetings and other meetings, which is pretty arduous travel. We need to do some travel to help him out. Next year, the meeting will be in Alaska. So it's a tough gig being part of the Western States. And that's all on my summer report for this meeting.
Any questions? And I guess we're on to item nine. Corporate governance issues.
Yes. No.
I skipped eight. On to item eight. Consideration of possible action following impaired and solvent member insurance.
Right. So let me give some updates on a couple of the active insolvencies. We don't talk about all the insolvencies, just some of the more active ones right now. And it's activities ebb and flow will take companies on and off this list. But first, I touch on just the overview. We have 20 active receiverships we're working with right now. We also have three additional companies that are under some type of rehabilitation order that we are monitoring in other states. During the first 5 months of 2023, we funded only $207,000 of benefit payments and obligations to policyholders. Of course, not what's not reported in here is Penn Treaty, because we funded that in 2017 in our payment to the long-term care LTC REIT captive owned by the Guaranty Associations. And I'll get some numbers later about how many claims are being paid for Texas policyholders from that. We did recover, first we have estimated about $28.3 million in remaining obligations at May 31st. This is significantly down from my estimates at the last board meeting because I revised the Friday insurance obligations a little bit. It's a very tough estimate, but working from the lag study at the last meeting to what we now know on claims, I reduced the estimate, but it's very much a rough number. But we think we owe about $28.3 million on the companies right now that we are currently already activated to provide benefits. Recoveries, that's where I was hitting. We made a significant recovery from the Penn Treaty insolvency since the last board meeting. I'll talk about that. We get to Penn Treaty, a little bit over $8 million. And we collected another $116,916 in premiums since the last meeting. On page 84, you'll see a summary of our customer service, I'll call it, our consumer service, phone calls, website visitors, things of that nature. And we included our 2023 complaint log on page 85, which is blank. You know, we went from 2011 until 2022 without a complaint. Then we had a written complaint, but they confused us with another company. But our guidelines are we get the complaint, we report it. So, but none have been received in 2023. So I'll start talking about some of the companies. I won't spend a lot of time on Friday, but just if you look as of May 31st, you'll see only admin expenses and meager admin expenses and no benefit payments. We didn't pay our first benefits until June, and now we've paid almost $14 million since June. And I've given quite a good discussion on Friday because some of this involves litigation, but we've made some changes in the policy and claims administration from the arrangement that we had to Friday Health Plans Management Company. We're going to be asking for some authority in just a moment to negotiate a different administrative arrangement because Friday Health Plans Management is now no longer in business. And we will be asking for authority to enter into agreements with UST Health Proof, Zealous, and then some cost-sharing arrangements with receivers in four other states. And those cost-sharing arrangements eventually will involve other Guaranty Associations as they become activated for the Friday entities in their states. I will say a liquidation order has already been entered against the HMO in Georgia, but it does not become effective until a week from today, August 1st. September 1st, liquidation order becomes effective against the HMO in North Carolina and the HMO in Oklahoma. There is a pending liquidation order against the insurance company in Nevada, and there is no liquidation petition filed yet. I don't believe, Jackie, against the HMO in Colorado. But all of them are going through enrollment for their exchanges, and their exchange policies are moving to other entities. So I'll just say one more time, we've paid approximately 95,000 claims, 13.2 million. We have around 4,200 grievances and appeals currently already submitted to be researched and resolved. Most of these are going to result in reprocessing of claims, but we anticipate for those 95,000 claims that we just sent out the door, there are going to be a number of appeals to those. So it's very likely that the Friday administration is going to continue throughout 2023 and into 2024. So as the grievances and appeals continue to be filed, we may have a better estimate of our exposure ready for your October meeting. And with that, I would ask the board to consider these resolutions on 8-9 to provide authority for me to participate in the stated administration arrangements and agreements. And I will mention that we're talking about the master service agreement with UST. That's an agreement that involved the receivers in four states and this Guarantee Association. But Jackie is the one that's drafting. And she's the lead drafter on behalf of all the entities on that master service agreement. And we are hopeful that the terms are finalized. The target date is Monday.
I'm happy to make the resolution. Right. Adding candles.
Jim Harrison, I'll second.
Any discussion or questions? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Thank you very much.
Okay. Let me give a little bit of update on Penn Treaty. We don't talk about it much, but before Friday, Penn Treaty took up about three quarters of my week each week. Now it takes up most of my nights because I'm doing Friday during the day. I still chair the Policy and Claims Administration Working Group for the Guarantee Association. That is a group made up of Guarantee Association administrators and industry reps. We are the frontline primary contact with the third party administrator that is handling all of the administration of the PIN Treaty and American Network long term care policies that are reinsured to our captive LTC read. So before I get into the administration numbers, let me mention excess benefits litigation. This was litigation that was going on for quite some time. The liquidator had set aside funds to pay amounts to the policyholders that had coverage that was projected to exceed Guarantee Association limits. So there were projections that certain people would have had coverage above limits and would have claims. And there was a mechanism set up to carve out, it was about $180 million to pay to those people. A group of health insurers objected to that application to the court, and there's been ongoing litigation for several years now. The Commonwealth Court held in favor of the health insurers, and it was appealed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and they just ruled in October of 2022 that the claimants projected to have claims in excess of Guarantee Association coverage only had claims for excess claims occurring within 30 days after the liquidation order was entered in March of 2017. In essence, no uncovered claims, no excess claims. So after some period of time, there was $178 million that is now freed up that would not be paid to those claimants and has now been distributed to the Guarantee Association. We received our $8.2 million in May. So that's another $8.2 million recovery for this association from the assets of the estate. $25 million was left in the receiverships to wind down PIN Treaty and American Network receiverships.
Bart, can I interject something? Yes. Right there? One of the primary reason that decision in Pennsylvania went the way it went was the law in Pennsylvania is different than it is in other states about these over the over limit claims for policyholders. And I think had the law in Pennsylvania been in line with the law of the other states like Texas, the result would have been different.
Well, I'm confused. Was this Warren Tech guessing that there would be over on people who hadn't even filed a claim yet?
There was a mechanism set up.
Wasn't there something where we invented a benefit when the person hadn't even filed a claim yet?
Well,
or is that something different?
No, because it's for the people who have a long-term care policy.
Yeah.
But they don't need to use it yet.
Right.
So we have to value their benefit in some way, right? And so that's how that came about.
And they had proposed, the liquidator had proposed that they could set these funds aside in some type of trust action. They had set up they were going to form their own captive to hold these funds. And then they would periodically evaluate any claims that exceeded guarantee association limits and make distributions to them and then reevaluate that periodically. So it would be an ongoing mechanism. I don't know how a preference would have been avoided because some of these claims may not exceed limits for 20 years,
yeah,
if ever. So it was very difficult. This is the case we also call it as a result of the Warren Tech case, the application of that decision out of the Reliance Insurance Company insolvency, or property casualty insolvency. And it was really the application of a decision on warranty claims from a property casualty insolvency to long-term care insolvency. And it's really kind of a mass mismatch. So this was an issue with some unique language in the liquidation statutes in Pennsylvania and a weird precedent from a property casualty insolvency because of the way the precedent was written. It was not clear that it only applied to property casualty. Got applied to a life and health, this long-term care insolvency. Very messy situation, and I'm kind of glad it's behind us. The result worked out in favor of the guarantee associations, but it was a messy case.
And yeah, I agree that Warren Tech shouldn't be applied, but how you create claims where they don't even exist yet, that was dumb.
We have worked with the receiver and the rehabilitator in this insolvency before. And there was an old insolvency out of Virginia called Fidelity Bankers, where they gave policyholders claims against the estate because they lost coverage. They didn't have claims, but their amount of coverage was reduced. And I don't know how you can have a claim against a receivership when you've not had a financial loss.
Yeah.
So it's a fine distinction under the law and some creative interpretation, but that's for another long discussion, not today. But this one is at least behind us. All right, let me give some numbers on Pintree. You can see there, for the 76 months that this company's been in liquidation, the Guarantee Association system has now paid out $1.4 billion in claims payments, another $133 million in cash buyouts under the rate increase program that was implemented nationally, collected $536 million in premiums. Look at just the Texas column. There are some commas missing under claims payments. That's topping. No, I didn't do that. $77,465,440 of benefits been paid to Texas claimants. We collected $30 million in premiums. We also paid out $6.5 million in cash buyout. So you think benefits, almost $84 million of benefits have been paid. We still have in Texas 1,860 active policies and 273 open and pending claims. Nationally, 36,000 policies. And we started with 71,000.
The main thing.
And 4,777 open and pending claims. Service level standards, our TPA, Davies Life and Health US. We have 25 service level standards that I track monthly. And then quarterly, they are applied against the standards, see if any financial penalties are due. During COVID, they had some significant issues with their call center and missed some of the service level standards and ended up paying some penalties to the guarantee associations and then provided some remediation plans. But since COVID has ended and the workforce has stabilized, they are meeting all 25 service level standards. First and second quarters of 2023, they fully complied with those service level standards. Some people call them key performance indicators, KPIs. So they're doing quite well. We are continuing to implement our wellness pilot program. I serve at a small group that guides that, and I work with our, I have weekly calls with our contractor assured allies. We have 6,373 policyholders that are in our control group and the same number in an intervention group. And with the intervention group, those are policyholders that we have offered participation in the program. And if they want to participate, they go through the screening and questionnaire process. We identify those that are at risk, and they are offered at no cost to them various types of assistance. And the interventions can be grab bars in their home. It may be non-skin services. It may be magnifying glasses, night lights, could be introduction to some of the community services available in their areas. It's a whole host of interventions. We finished our first year, and we began what we call the gap year on May 23. It will go for one more year, and in that, we paid an additional fee to Assured Allies, but they are implementing some new approaches in addition to reaching out and offering policyholders that did not respond to the first contact, reaching out to them to see if there are any needs or any policyholders at risk, because these policyholders over a few months, their conditions may significantly change and they need assistance. They're also implementing a signals program where our third-party administrator identifies and left with about 25 different signals. It may be death of a spouse, introduction of a new power of attorney, a phone call inquiring about benefits. So we have various signals that may indicate this policyholder may be at risk and need benefits, and intervention could provide good services and prolong their ability to stay at home and not need benefits under their insurance policy. So that program has just started. We're kicking it off, and we track the claims for both control and intervention groups to see if this is working. Wellness has been around in managed care for a while. It has worked very well, and they see more immediate results. Long-term care, it is a new area. Wellness programs are new. This is a pilot by us to see how it works. We're seeing it takes much longer to see the benefits comparing our interventions moving that claims needle at all. So we'll continue to track it. The next program I'll talk about, this was just implemented, you know, kind of a pet peeve of mine because I killed an EVV program, electronic visit verification, that PIN treaty had in place. I didn't like the vendor, and I thought it was very discriminatory the way they implemented it. So as part of PACA, I said, stop. They only had 100 people on it, and it just wasn't working. So we went through a process and identified a new vendor. We chose AssuraCare. They're one of the first companies to use EVV. And in that, we began for the first 3 months, any new long-term care claimants with home health care claims involving private or family caregivers. We rolled out to them, here is your reporting process, use EVV. So their caregivers use an app to record when they arrive and leave the home where the care is being provided to the claimant, and they record their instrumental activities of daily living or activities of daily living that they perform while they're there. It's a little bit of an educational process. We also have geofencing. We look at geofencing reports monthly, and we had 8 last month that kind of jumped off the page. They're checking in, and they're not near the claimant's home. And they're driving all around. Are they doing errands? Are they doing other things? And why is this person 500 miles away at a beach resort?
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so there are some benefits. This will trim fraud, waste, and abuse in 2 ways. Obvious fraud, but also tightening. You know, some of the old statement of care forms that were submitted by hand, you see the same thing every day. The exact same activities being performed, and they're checking in at 8, leaving at 4. Checking in at 8, leaving at 1. Well, maybe they got there at 8:45 and left at 12:30. That little bit of time adds up in dollars. And it's not just our claims benefits we're paying. It reduces some of the eligible benefits available to those claimants. Remember, they only have $300,000 in benefits available from the Guarantee Association. Okay, they don't need to be wasting that. They need to manage those dollars. So we're already seeing some good benefits. We expanded the program on June 26th. Besides new claimants and existing claimants, introduced new private caregivers. As existing claimants come up on their annual recertifications, we are offering them the EVP process. Now, it sounds like we're just policing and being the watchdogs, but this is a simplified reporting. It's a cleaner, quicker reporting, and payments get issued quicker. The information from the vendor to our TPA comes through an API. It's automatically information is sent, and you don't have the hard copy forms to deal with. So a much easier process, much quicker process. We'll have more to report on this, but you're going to see some reports on some fraud and waste cases as well. GA coverage, I mentioned that the in-force policies had gone from 71,000 down to about 33,000. But if you look at this, there have only been 1,328 policies out of the 36,000 that have dropped off. Only 1,328 have exhausted Guarantee Association coverage. So we do monitor this. We do track it. We make sure that the policy holders are provided with notice when they reach 75% of level of their benefits, again at 90%, and then we give them a final letter that you have no longer any benefits available on the Guarantee Association. So it helps just manage our policyholder block. The last thing I'll mention, we did another claims audit. We engaged a firm, a local insurance company here in Austin, Continental General, as a long-term care company. And they performed a claims audit, and it came out very, very well. Davies did an excellent job. There were a handful of items recommended that could be touched up. Those were handed to my group, PACA. We have revised three specific letters. I won't go into the details that are template letters we use on different instances. Some appeal language, restoration of benefits. Waiver of premium. And then we're looking at two processes, how claims are handled and paid under alternative plan of care. You're familiar with long-term care policies, how APOC works, but it's a little different. But the benefits paid into that. And then we're also looking at some of these policyholders have multiple policies. And the process, if they call in to open a claim, do you open a claim under all their policies or only one? You want to make sure you're not inadvertently denying the availability of benefits to a claimant. So we're just scrubbing it and refining the processes. But it's normal, even in a very clean audit, there are processes that can be tweaked. And with that, that's my report on pen treaty. I'll touch on two more small insolvencies. North Carolina Mutual, it's not really a small company, but it's a messy company. This is a life insurance company out of North Carolina, wrote a lot of small face amount life business and around 250,000 policies. And I think they only have valid addresses for about 90,000 of them. So this is another situation similar to what we have on Calante that we're administering in-house, that you don't have a good way to contact the policyholders, and you are waiting really for them to contact you and make a claim for benefits. So today we've only had 13 batches of claims submitted. We funded about $125,000 claims. We expect more. You can see the estimated coverage of our life policies, death benefits around $10.5 million, cash surrender value, $1.15, and then annuities, only a handful of annuities in Texas, about $82,000 in value. But we do track these as they come through. And occasionally there are reallocations of policies. I mentioned that there are bad addresses for a large number of policies, but those are all assigned to the North Carolina Guarantee Association because of reciprocity, and that's the state where they're domiciled. As claims occurred, we get better information. We find out this policy has always been in Texas. Well, it's taken off North Carolina list and added to the Texas list and the claims sent to us. So our numbers can change as we move forward. Last company. This is a new company. This is one of the three global companies we mentioned earlier. Bankers Life and Colorado Bankers are not yet in liquidation. Their liquidation orders are under appeal. Southland National's liquidation order was entered, is final and effective. And that occurred on May 2nd of this year. We are processing and paying claims as they come due. These are prepaid burial policies. And so they're small face amount. They're almost all assigned to be paid to funeral homes. We've done the audit and some of the claims coming through. This is different from Lincoln Memorial because these policies did have a growth component on the death benefit. So on all the policies so far, we have paid more than the face amount of the policies, but it is permitted in the policies and that value does grow. So to date, we have paid $71,000 in claims across four batches, and we think we have cash surrender values of $7.5 million, but we only have cash surrender values. I am working to try to get estimated face amounts and have them rolled forward to be what, with those base amounts, what's the estimated death benefits today? And those numbers are just not captured in a system. And we're working with a task force actually to come up with a way to estimate that, because I think our exposure is going to be substantially more than $7.5 million.
Are y'all the permit holder too?
No.
So you don't have to deal with the Department of Banking?
Oh, I did deal with the Department of Banking. They call. And because I know them working at Lincoln Memorial, and said, Bart, we want to find out about the growth factor of these policies. So I only have a handful. I'm still trying to get policy forms. Submitted a request to TDI, and it was told that I need to do an open records request. Well, I found another way, and I got the policy forms. And looking at the policy forms and auditing the claims that have come through, I went to the TPA that we're using. That TPA is the company that is actually the permit holder. So they have all the records. So I was able to get the records from them and do a comparison. And then I went back to our friends at the Department of Banking, put them in touch with the permit holder, and their process has started their regular audits. So this is running a little bit smoother than Lincoln Memorial, but it's the same type of business. And that's all I have on the insolvencies, unless there are questions.
On to item 9?
Yes.
Corporate governance.
So at the April meeting, we were preparing a recommendation in response to some concerns raised by the board of directors regarding the burdensome approach we use to do board of directors self-evaluation. If you recall, there was a questionnaire that was distributed every fall, and it coincided with the same time a lot of other evaluations and questionnaires and documentation were being requested. And it was quite a burden on the board to do a self-evaluation at the same time. So we recommended a two-stage approach. One would be that we add this item, a sub-item called director's feedback, to every corporate governance agenda item every meeting. So every meeting, there's going to be director's feedback. And when the material is distributed in advance of the meeting, like I did last week, I would say, if you have any feedback on any items, and I gave you the list of the things that are normally part of the self-evaluation. If you have any concerns or issues that you'd like to discuss with the board, let me know in advance of the meeting so I can make sure and screen them. Should they be handled in open session or executive session? So this was the first attempt to use this two-stage process, the first stage being that request for any issues want to be discussed. No issues were raised, so there's nothing to discuss today. The next stage is the more extensive, and it's going to be done in October. Will there be an agenda item when we talk specifically about the items in the self-evaluations? But without doing the self-evaluation, we're going to have a discussion of them. So it's an ongoing process that a once a year written evaluation. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So this will take some time to unfold, and it's anticipated that we may go meeting after meeting after meeting. There's nothing come up. But when something, an issue arises, we now have a mechanism to talk about it. And that's the intent.
And that also doesn't prohibit a board member from raising something, you know, in between a meeting or something like that. We wanted to make sure there was a sort of the regular reminder of this is the way to bring up governance and board feedback.
And that feedback could be about something I do, could be something that Jackie does or Jim. So we have said you can raise these issues with Jackie, with Jim, with Bart, with Shelby. However you're most comfortable raising these issues, bring them up before the meeting. And the reason before the meeting, just so we address them properly. Shelby, you were part of this process to come up with the it's two-stage approach. Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think you've covered it. I think this is going to accomplish the same objective, giving the board a regular opportunity to air any issues that they have, and yet it's going to decrease the burdensome nature of having to fill out a written questionnaire. So, and as Jackie said, if anyone, I think the actual practice has always been if somebody had an issue, directors historically haven't been shy about raising their hand and voicing it, which is great. So, but I think this is a welcome slight revision to the self-evaluation process that will work well.
I'd like to raise an issue. I feel like Bart missed something in item number 8, and I'm really annoyed about it. No, seriously.
I did miss something.
Yeah.
And it's unusual that this comes up, and that's why I forgot it. The topic did remind me, if you'll give me just a minute, I need to stop the share and put up a different document on screen. So give me just a moment to get this ready. Make sure I have it.
Oh, Jared. Jared.
Yeah. I'm glad I can watch both things. It's only your screen. Okay.
It came up on this screen.
Came up down here. Okay, here we go. Thank you, everyone, for bearing with me. I almost got it up on screen. Just a moment.
Then you choose share.
Yes, I'm working on it.
Thank you.
Okay, what is sharing? Okay.
You can see it online.
Yeah, yeah. We can see it on the Zoom side.
I just have two things up in previews there. We had a phone call come into the office about Bankers Life Insurance Company. And although we have no authority to do anything on Bankers Life, it is public that a liquidation order has been entered and appealed against the company. We have been getting inquiries from bankers and Colorado Bankers Policyholders and annuity contract holders for quite some time. 81 consumers specifically, when they own an annuity with Bankers Life, contacted us and wanted to address the board with his concerns regarding Bankers Life. I had talked and responded to him and say, send me your concerns and I will share them with the board. Then I'll respond to you afterwards. So what I have on screen is a redacted email that the policyholder sent to me, raising concerns about the harm being inflicted on the annuity owners of Bankers Life. And he mentions that it has been 4 years since all this began. It has been longer, but the harm, I think he's referencing, did begin in June of 2019 when the North Carolina court entered a moratorium against that purport that prevented the voluntary withdrawal of any funds from these annuity contracts. So mandatory IRS distributions are made, but none others. So most of these annuity contract holders are at the point that they have no surrender charges left on their annuities. And if it were not for this court order, they could have taken out the funds. In addition, as you'll see in the bolded section here, he mentions that prevailing interest rate is well over 5%.
Sure.
That's what other insurance companies are paying. They reduced the interest crediting rate on these annuities for this company that is in a pending liquidation status to 1%. So these policyholders are only getting 1% on their funds and they can't withdraw them. And King has written and asked, is there anything that can be done? And he wanted to have access to what he calls the Texas Insurance Funds, but to this guarantee association. He wants protection. And he's asking this board to appeal to the Insurance Commissioner of North Carolina to petition court for relief on behalf of annuity owners. And he's already sent a letter to the commissioner. He did send me a copy of his letter. Or he says possible that legislation could be modified to allow earlier payment in cases like these in the long term. Well, I have drafted a response. I can also put that on screen quickly. Send this policyholder.
It's not in receivership. It's not even in.
It's in receivership, but it's not in liquidation.
It's not in liquidation.
It is. So there's a liquidation order, but it's on appeal.
Yeah, it just seems strange that you could have a 4-year moratorium.
I don't think the idea of the moratorium was that they would last that long.
Yeah, I mean, usually it's
6 months.
Yeah.
Did COVID, did it get caught up in COVID delays or something like that?
Hang on. I'm having trouble multitasking. Let me bring this up. I'll answer your question. Okay. Okay. Let me share again.
We can see it.
Oh, you can see it now.
Good. Yep.
In one place. South place. Okay. So what you have on the screen there is I drafted a response to this gentleman to cover a few key points. I had already written him last week, just acknowledged receipt of his email that we would be back in touch with him this week. But I wanted to describe a little bit about what the association was in the second paragraph here, and that we have no authority to provide protection to policyholders until liquidation orders entered against the company. And I pointed out that the liquidation order for Bankers is not final, as it's being appealed. So we have no authority to do anything with respect to the Bankers annuities. And just pointed out that it is subject to a receivership proceeding in North Carolina. Yes, there is a moratorium there that the court did. And only the North Carolina court and the insurance regulators have the authority to take any action for Bankers. And that we are not a state agency and not a part of the Texas Department of Insurance. And this is the essence. I can't say contact the Department of Insurance, but I have to make the distinction. We're not part of the Texas Department of Insurance. There have been a few complaints filed with the Texas Department of Insurance about Bankers or Colorado Bankers, but very few officers just don't know what to do. And I pointed out that should the appeal be denied, that 90 days after that liquidation order, and 90 days after that denial, the liquidation order will become effective and will be activated. And we will provide protection. But I wanted to make sure and tell them that that protection has limits. And for annuity contracts, it's in two ways. We can't pay more than $250,000 to any individual, irrespective of how many annuities they own with that company. We can only pay $250,000. But I thought it also be important to point out what we call the Moody's limitation. And that's the limitation on the interest accumulation in the four-year period prior to our activation. And here's a calculation we have performed based on the statute. And I just gave them an example. If it were to happen today, the limitation on the four-year period prior to the liquidation date is 1.75%. So if his contract was paying 3, we would calculate the value for that, recalculate the value for that 3-year, that 4-year period from 3.75. And that new value is what we would be checking. Even if it's less than $250,000, there is an interest rate limitation. In this situation, I did not write it in here, but they came up. I don't know when they changed the interest rate to 1%. But if it's been 1% for the last 4 years, there's no Moody's adjustment then. So, and then I ended the to just say, we're ready. And we'll fulfill our protection to the banker's annuity contracts should that liquidation order become final and effective. So it's just to clarify, this is what we do, but we don't have authority to do anything right now. And I've written this to many, a lot of these bankers and thought bankers, people who write this to a lot of people while they're in rehabs or before a trouble company gets to the Guaranty Association. And a lot of consumers just want to know what we do. But this was the first that said, I want to address the board. So you normally don't see all of these emails I send, but this is standard language and a standard response. There are just limitations on when we can provide protection, what that protection is, but when it occurs, we're there.
The excellent response.
So there's really no action. It's just reporting to you. And I did promise the gentleman that I would advise the board of making be aware. I do think when I emailed him a couple of times, he was just comforted to hear from someone. Mm-hmm. Because the last couple of people he'd written to, they didn't respond. And now he actually has someone he can talk to. Mm-hmm. So that's all I have on it. It's an unfortunate situation. I have been involved in many insolvencies. I've done some 150 or more. I think probably more. And moratorium have been used. It's rare to see a moratorium go beyond 1 year. Most of the time, it's 6 months. To have this go 4 years, it's a little extreme. And to answer Patty's question, in this situation, you would think that the commissioner could have moved for liquidation more quickly. But there were so many, there were some 500 to 600 intertwined affiliate transactions in these local bankers that it was hard to come up with what's the true value. Is this company insolvent or not? And when you go to petition for a liquidation order, Brian will tell you, you kind of need to prove the company's insolvent. And it does help. And they just needed time to unwind this mess. And it's unfortunate, but it took that long.
So how long was he in control of the company?
No, I can't recall when he actually bought it when it was a Colorado company, redomesticated in North Carolina because he found some latitude in the laws on investments. I can't remember. We started reading about him in the Wall Street.
I was just going to say, 4 or 5 years ago. And they just had to reach them in the last
just,
6 months.
I'm just saying that it's taken longer to unwind it than he
probably
had it.
Well, and if you read some of the pleadings in his indictment, about the time they would pursue something, he would unravel a new scheme. another financial transaction or introduce, well, I've got a new money manager. There's another entity he created. And it just added to the puzzle. And every time I think they put a piece in the puzzle got bigger.
The affiliate transactions he kept doing, were they just stuff that he should have filed for approval under the Holding Company Act, or were they underneath limits?
I think he did file, but it was an inexperienced commissioner, wasn't it?
I think that was part of it.
Yes.
I don't know exactly what all that.
North Carolina.
And there was a lot to this, and there was a bribe against, that's what he was in prison for, bribing the commissioner. And he tried to have the examiner that was examining his company reassigned. There's a lot to this case. A lot of pressure.
Curious, you know, how many, you know, with all the holding company affiliate filings that we do, how you have this many, and some of the sales and stuff, there are materiality triggers, but I don't know, just amazing to me how you can have that kind of intertwined with that many affiliate transactions. Just seems bizarre.
I thought I understood a lot of the financial transactions, and I started reading through the indictment that came down against Mr. Lindbergh, and about 30 pages into it, I was completely lost. It was a mess. So it's interesting reading, but to unravel it, I don't know how many months it took just to draft that feed, not even thinking about the research, just to pull it together into something cogent. It's a mess. So
were they challenging the insolvency? Is that why it's still in the court system?
Yes.
So until the court decides or rejects it?
The holding company called GBIG,
G-B-I-G,
has appealed the liquidation order. Okay. So that's all I had on going back to that last item on item 8. Okay. So we're ready for item 10.
Yeah, the minority.
So every year we bring to you the draft Form 990, the return of organization exempt from income tax. Jarrett assembled the 990. And share it with me. I review it. We send it to our outside CPA firm, Clifton Larson Allen. And they have some software they run it against, plus they give it a review. Jared, you want to add? I don't think they had any revisions this year.
No, there were no revisions this year. And just for your information, there's no action required on this. It's just part of the best practices, and it's actually included in the 990 that the board of directors has a chance to review and ask any questions before we file it.
Yes, the 990 always asks, has this submission been reviewed by the governing entity of the governing body of the entity? And, you know, years ago, the 990s got substantially expanded. They're very long now. A lot of information on it. They are public filings. GuideStar.com is a free service. You can go out there and look at the 990 on file for any entity. All ours are out there. I love it because that's, my salary is out there public for the whole world to view. Thanks a lot, IRS. But that's part of being in the nonprofit world. So we did distribute the 990 through the portal to the board because in draft form, it is confidential. Once filed, it is public. Were there any questions from the board? And I think that's just a reporting item, Jim.
Okay. Number 11, I think Jarrett's up. Consideration possible action.
So, Jared, I'm going to put it on the screen, let you walk through it. Jared always walks us through the changes and balances and how money flows through and is reflected in the financial statements. So, Jared has a couple items to point out in these quarterly statements. So, Jared, how about it?
So let's just start there at the top of the page. You know, normally our practice is to keep around $2.5 million in cash and money market funds, and the rest in treasury bills with about $2 million maturing each quarter, and we'll use those funds if we need them, or just reinvest them if we don't. But as we started learning Friday, beginning in March, as some of these treasuries matured, we started holding on to that cash in order to accumulate funds to be able to pay those obligations. And actually in April and May, you'll see a little later, we actually sold a couple just to be able to build those funds up. Bart had mentioned in May that we received an $8.2 million recovery distribution for Penn Treaty. You'll see that reflected in the total cash and cash equivalents there in May. You'll see that $8.2 million came up in there. Bart also talked about, moving to the middle of the page, talked about the issues we had with coming up with the obligations for Friday using the lag study that we had. So you'll see beginning in March, we booked a really high obligation and a corresponding unbilled assessment, which we then adjusted down, or Bart adjusted down in April as we got better information and make better estimates. And then in May, it was adjusted down again. However, it was offset a little bit for the Southland National that we were activated for in May.
Hey, Jared?
Yes.
Could you mention something about when we had the necessity to accumulate more funds, have liquid funds available to meet the obligations coming due on Friday? How were we holding those funds with the new arrangements we had at the Chase Bank?
Sure. So, you know, normally the board wants us to keep no more than $250,000 in cash so we can have the FDIC protection. We started running, and so we had sweep accounts set up to where anything above these target balances would be swept overnight into a 100% U.S. Treasury fund, and therefore we could keep our $250,000 balance. However, those sweeps have a maximum. The bank will only allow us to sweep $10 million. So we had to come up with a new solution, which we came up with it's called a Morgan Money Fund, which is a direct investment into the 100% U.S. Treasury money market funds. So now we try to put everything in that and move it over, because we can move that on a daily basis as needed into the cash account to fund expenses as they come due.
Thank you.
Okay. So down at go ahead.
You want to go to the next page?
No. Well, down at the bottom of this page, you'll see, you know, the thing that really only moves our net position is money coming in the door and money going out the door paying claims and expenses. You know, we have these huge obligation swings here because of the Friday and then the Southland National, but that really has no impact on our bottom line for the total net position because they're offset each other. So I just wanted to point out that if you look at the May net position down at the bottom, you'll see in March and April, it kind of stays real close, but then we have that big swing because of those obligations and because of the $8.2 million distribution. All right, next page, please.
Thank you.
Once again, this is just showing those Friday obligations. You'll see in the operating income, we have a change in unbilled assessment of $43 million in March, and that is almost a direct offset to the change in expenses and that change in obligations there. And you'll see that kind of follows through for each month. Down at the bottom, the note down there, you'll see in April and May, we had to liquidate a couple of treasuries to start accumulating those Friday funds, and there was a gain on both of those months. So we will book that as a gain on the disposal of an asset. Not necessarily an issue or a problem because it's not big money, but you have to be real careful that you don't start running into unrelated business income issues as a nonprofit. Next page, please. Once again, this is just a showing through the cash flow statement. of the change in the obligations and the change in the unbilled assessment. You can see those basically offset each other. And down there, you'll see the increase in the long-term investments, which was that $8.2 million from Penn Treaty. And then I have one more item to point out on page 11-7. So at the last board meeting, the board authorized us to pay off some accumulated borrowings for various insolvencies that we had been borrowing funds from Lincoln Memorial. And so we were going to pay those off from the Lincoln Memorial funds. So the $502,000 repayments was that repayment of those borrowed funds. And then because we are not paying the Friday expenses from Lincoln Memorial, we have an additional $161,000 in borrowings for Friday that will be paid back once we receive some early access funds from Friday. That is all I have on the financial statements, unless you have any questions.
Thanks, Jared.
Mm-hmm.
Item 12, the calendar activities.
Well, as always, I'll show the first page. We provide a calendar like this of all board activities and then keep subset calendars for each of the various committees that identify upcoming work and work that has been accomplished or performed with the dates that they were performed. So those calendar of activities, I will post the updated one at this meeting to the portal so you ever want to see what's coming up for the board or dates we have things scheduled. Those calendar activities are always there on the portal. The next meeting of the board is regularly scheduled for Tuesday, October 24th. There will be, in connection with that board meeting, probably 2 weeks in advance, there will be an audit committee meeting. The audit committee always meets in October. So those two meetings will be coming up in October. We have no identified needs for any internal meetings at this time.
Is there any other business? Anything we need to discuss? Okay. And the time is 11:18 a.m. on July 25th, 2023, and this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Carrying Association that has been held pursuant to the Texas Open Meeting Act is adjourned.